listening to The Subtext from American Theater Magazine, and I'm your host, Brian James Polak. If you are a regular listener, you might have noticed a larger-than-usual gap between episodes because I'm pretty much technologically inept. Nonetheless, I persisted through my own stupidity, and here we are with another episode. If you're listening for the first time, ignore what I just said. I'm a genius, and that's all you need to know. This episode is packed with two shorter conversations I had with playwrights Audrey Cephaly and Lisa Langford. These were amongst the gaggle of conversations I recorded while at the NNPN showcase in Sacramento back in December. Up first is Audrey Cephaly. Audrey is a Southern writer and Alabama native based in Washington, D.C. Her plays include The Gulf, Alabaster, Maytag Virgin, The Last Wide Open, and Love is a Blue Tick Hound. She's a recipient of the Edgerton Award, Lammy Award, Samuel French Off-Off-Broadway Festival winner, David Colicchio Prize for Marin Theater, and was a Charles MacArthur Award nominee. Here is my conversation with the wonderful Audrey Cephaly, recorded in one of B Street Theater's conference rooms.
I know there have definitely been times when I have, like even as recent as a couple of years ago, where I've seen other people sort of get, you know, certain milestones. I'm like, you know, my work is good enough for that, you know. And it just sort of drives home this point of like, there's no fairness to it because it's, the business is so subjective.
Yeah.
All these selection committees and everything. It's not like there's one person reading 500 scripts. It's like dozens and dozens of people, you know, getting you to the first round and other people getting you to the next round. And it's just this strange, weird thing of committee after committee, and they're all curating subjectively, and so it can really mess with your head a little bit. Like, it's not like there's an objective metric, right, for judging writing. It's like,
right.
What do you dig? What turns you on?
What turns this one particular person on in this one particular moment? Right?
Yeah.
And sometimes it just comes down to that.
It could be the best melodrama or the best farce ever written, and somehow the people on the committee are like, oh, I just, not another farce, or not another two-hander, or not another, you know. And it, but objectively speaking, that's craftsmanship right there. And unfortunately,
yeah,
there's not enough personnel and not enough hands on deck to really nurture these playwrights and say, no, but really, honestly, we all thought that it was a fantastic showing, a fantastic script. It's just, we can't fit it in here. Like, I remember and still do, like, live off of those kinds of rejection letters. Mm-hmm. You know, at least it's something. Most of the time, we just get, you know, static.
Do you ever get rejected and never hear?
Yeah.
That happens to me all the time. And what drives me crazy is somebody will post on their social media, I'm a finalist for X. And I'll be like, oh, I haven't heard yet. I must be a finalist too. And then I will never hear.
Mm-hmm.
And it drives me crazy. I'd rather be flat out rejected and just told, so I'm not thinking, hitting refresh on my email every 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's a closure thing.
Just close it out, yeah. But I can't even tell you how many times. I feel like, did I misspell my email address when I submitted this thing in the first place?
Right, right. And I think, too, like, certainly the heartbreaking thing is that just because, you know, if your colleague gets an award and you don't get an award, it's not like your work was any lesser than your colleague's work, but one person has to get the award. And it's important to remember that it's just like, well, you'll get there. It's not like, what is the meme that goes around? It's like, you know, a win for me doesn't mean nothing for you. It's not pie, you know, it's not, you know, so
mm-hmm.
be happy and supportive, demonstratively so, with your colleagues when they do have those wins, because sometimes that's the only affirmation they get.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take anything at all, really, to just to congratulate, you know, your colleagues when they do win, on the, even on the small victories. It's just a very sensitive thing. I know people that have gone off social media because they can't, they think of it as like a competition, or they think of it like they just can't, they can't deal with all, everyone else around them seemingly, you know, succeeding, and they can't get any traction on their writing, and so they're like, well, I'm tapping out because this is just too much of a head game for me and I can't deal with it. So it's a very sensitive thing. And so when people go online and they're like, oh, I'm a finalist, especially when they haven't really been given the green light to talk about it yet,
right? Yeah,
is maybe not cool, and also maybe not the most sensitive thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, other people are waiting to hear.
Yeah.
So
the way one of the ways I navigate it is I kind of lock into not the spirit of competition, but the spirit of advocacy, where I am rooting for the people closest to me. So I end up connecting with somebody I like, and I don't get the thing, but they do. And that still, that makes me feel good. You know, it's not a win for me, but it's a win. It's a win for you. That's not as good as a win for me. I'll still take a win for me, but it's awesome that this person that I like and admire is getting it. Yeah. And I really kind of like lean into that because I like when good things happen to the good people who are putting in the work, you know?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, they talk about artists at a certain level that sort of have a responsibility to support their colleagues, especially support ones that are coming up. Just identifying the people in your world, the new writers, the emerging writers, artists of all kinds, really, that you see that spark of genius in them. And it's, I believe it's important to actively, you know, actively reach out and say, how are you doing? You know, it, you know, I want, don't forget to submit for this upcoming festival. I'm sure that you knew that, but let me know if I can help, or it's amazing what having that sort of buddy or that partner can do, just to sort of help you know that you're on the, you know, that you're on the right track, and that someone that you really kind maybe even really look up to thinks that you have something. That meant the world to me when I was first starting out. And I look at the first script that I wrote, and I read it now, and I think, wow, that was a really bad script. Now, it did win a festival.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, everyone was like, don't ever stop. This is amazing. It was like, it stood out somehow as bad as I think it is now. At that time, it stood out from the others in the festival. So I knew I had something, but that was so long ago. And I read it now and I think, oh, I've learned so much since then. But it meant a lot to me that people at that time encouraged me. And I think what I've sort of recognized is that writing, playwriting, of course, it's a collaborative medium, and we all sort of exist in this kind of, we're all in this together. It's not a solitary sort of thing. So it's you, it's the audience, and it's, is it recording?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, so it's not a solitary medium, right? It's you, it's the audience, and it's your personal fans, like your little, your group of colleagues,
right, yeah,
and co-writers, right? And if you really, if you start out knowing that you have like friends that are willing to read your work and tell you honestly what you can do to improve it, they will be honest with you and they'll say, I love it when you do this.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience will say the same thing. Oh, I saw this one play and I really, that really spoke to me. So if you start listening to the things that other people are leaning into and keep doing more of that, then now you've got this really happy ecosystem that's like, oh, you're giving content that people want.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in turn supporting you and boosting the signal, it's an affirming act when they do that. And it's just a, it's a beautiful cycle.
And do you feel like you have that?
Oh yeah, yeah. I do. I have a lot of support. Sometimes I feel quite old when I think of all the faces and support of people that have really given that kind of support to me over the years, whether it's table reads or I have super fans that kind of show up wherever. Like, I had a friend show up at Shepherdstown recently, and I was like, oh my gosh, she drove all the way to West Virginia for this so reading, great. You know? So I feel like I do, but I feel like everybody deserves that, you know? Everybody deserves that kind of support.
I believe everybody does deserve it. I think it is really a struggle for a lot of people to find that, because a lot of people get into being a writer because it's a thing that they can do by themselves. But when it comes to playwriting, you can only do so much by yourself. Like you said, it's a communal, theater is a communal activity. You need people around you in order to realize this thing. And I think it is hard for a lot of people to find a circle, to find a people. And being here when I'm learning about NNPN, for example, is, you know, NNPN isn't a thing you access, right? NNPN is for theaters.
Right.
And it's not for the playwright to access anyway. The theater is the place for the playwright to access, who will then advocate for them at the NNPN level.
Right.
And it's kind of like this weird, I think playwrights who aren't part of the system, who aren't on the inside, don't realize that. I think the question is, how do I get to NNPN?
It is. Well, that's the question you read in all the books. Well, how do you start out? You know, like I wrote an article for Breaking Character magazine about this. It was about the short form as sort of a really vibrant and important medium, because a lot of people start out and cut their teeth on the short form.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think it's a great way to learn the business, because you're having to decipher all the submission opportunities I remember that theater was really nice when I submitted. And you know what? I've submitted to this place a couple times and they've never given me any regard at all. Mm-hmm. And it's at once, you know, informative and educational. It can be heartbreaking. But in this article, I talk about they're like, well, you know, work with your local theater to do this. Work with your colleagues or whatever to do this. And they're like, I would gladly do that. I just don't know how to make that happen. And it's just so for some people, it just seems self-evident.
Yeah.
And they have that pathway established. For me, I was lucky because I had had, I was aligned with a group where I had, you know, I used to be really big into performance. And so I already had that pathway. But a lot of writers never have that. They don't have that. So they like, well, how do I find that?
It's really true. And I do think there's a feeling, and again, I kind of am playing devil's advocate a little bit and saying this because I've been on the inside for so long working in a theater. So I kind of see how the theater itself works. But speaking to the perception from the community community of playwrights who are not connected, that, you know, to use NNPN as an example, you need to get to a theater, like you just said, work with your local theater. Well, the perception is the local theater is actually looking at the pipeline of American theater, which is coming from Yale and the O'Neill Conference and all of these people that are getting all the things, and there's maybe a dozen of them. So my local theater is not looking towards me in the community. They're looking towards, you know, the pipeline that is of all the people that are already deemed appropriate to tap into.
Right.
That's not universal, and that's not necessarily true. That is probably true from, you know, it's at a lot of theaters, but it's not a universal truth. But it is a feeling amongst the playwrights who are stuck in their own silos and wanting to get out and wanting to work with their local theater. But it's not that easy to just knock on the door of your local theater and say, hey, I want to work with you. I need an artistic home.
Yeah, I, you know, when I think of a local theater, I think of like something at either the amateur or semi-pro level. When you're first starting out in writing, obviously, that's the most accessible place. Look around it. one-act festivals in your area or in your region that are looking for plays, and just start, you know, write a little thing and submit. Yes, it's super important. Try to find a writing group. They're going to let you know about opportunities. Mm-hmm. A lot of things happen in this business word of mouth. And it's, I wish there was a formula, but I do strongly believe that good writing always wins. Good writing will always rise to the top. And whether you write that all alone and maybe you have one person look at it, or whether you have a whole tribe of people, mm-hmm. I think eventually good writing is going to rise above the noise and get noticed. But you have to be ruthless with the editing and ruthless with yourself about not allowing anything in the script to be sacrosanct, really, really, really distilling the narrative. Now I focus a lot on character studies. Most of my plays are character studies, and so I find that, like, I'm pathological with, like, distillation and the reduction of noise and all that. I just find that, you know, tension isn't something that just magically lands in your script. I suppose it could from time to time, but tension exists in the absence of noise. And if you have a very, you know, trippy, sort of heavy laden script with a lot of words, well, that's great. You're getting all your words out there, congratulations, mm-hmm. but you're not going to have any tension. So that's one of the first things that I try to express to young writers is trim all the fat. Just trim it all. Trim it all. You don't need to say it all.
Right.
You don't need to, just like in acting, you don't need to say it all. Leave some air. Leave a sentence unanswered. Leave a rhetorical question. Leave a void. Let action speak in the silent moments. That's all really good stuff. So anyway, I just think it's important to listen.
A lot of us playwrights are sort of introverted by nature. And that's mm-hmm. one thing that allows us to be able to tap into the things we need to tap into in order to create these characters and write these stories. But we are working in an industry that requires human connection, right? So like you were just saying, you advise young people to be able to, you know, listen to other people, give you it's making that connection that is so hard sometimes, right?
It's really hard.
How did you, I mean, I don't know you enough to you know, label you introvert, extrovert, but, you know, how did you make that leap?
Well, you know, I think I used to be an extrovert. I used to not have any issues at all. Like, I had a couple really close collaborators and dramaturgs over the years, friends that were really so in tune with what I was trying to say as an artist that really they were working with me as a dramaturg, like as a full, you know, like a partner, like a writing partner almost. So I would say to the introvert, go to the person that you trust the most that has the best taste. Mm-hmm. Who's going to tell you that's stinky? I mean, I remember showing up at a one-act festival. I had written this political piece, a 10-minute play for the Capital Fringe Festival, and it was some horrible, horrible, regrettable play about Dick Cheney. And my friend Erica, who had been working with me on several plays by that point, she leaned over to me at the end of that production, and she goes, "You want my opinion?" I was like, "Yeah." She said, "Let that one go."
Did you listen?
So I did.
Yeah.
I learned that night that I should never write political plays. I should never, even though there's politics in my plays, but that I should not stick to what I know, not stay in my lane, because I really hate it when people put conditions on their artists, like, just keep writing for women, because that's what you do best. Oh, okay. So, you know, there's no good men stories out there. You know, like, it's weird how people put conditions on the artist. But that's a whole other podcast. But that I should, you know, what I'm really, really good at and what I know I'm really good at is love stories. And I don't just mean falling in love stories. I mean in it, like in the shit love stories. I mean like relationships imploding love stories. I mean, yeah. Like I think I've run out of chances love stories. And, you know, to be seen, Alabaster, you know, this weekend is basically... it's basically a love story. It's two people really wanting to be seen, and both of them sort of, you know, feeling as if they're just too messed up for love, you know? And it's about healing and all that kind of stuff. So I know now that when I write those, I'm at my best when I'm writing those kinds of stories. And as George Saunders put it, and I'll never forget this beautiful thing that he said about editing, you know, when you go through your story and you feel that your lines or your words are kind of less than your best, you know, really be ruthless with yourself about expecting more. Like, real love is asking your characters, how can I love you right now? Instead of just letting your characters go on and on with empty sentiment and all that, say, wait, hold on a second. How can I love you right now? And he really believes that nurturing those characters all along the way brings out our better nature. When we care about the syllables, when we don't just write dismissive language and we dig below shallow sentiment to see what's underneath it, then we begin to really see the scars of these of your characters, like what they really ache for. And that is a heightened reality that everyone can relate to, because, like, I'm sitting across from you now, and I might not, you know, I might not understand your particular story or your particular path in life, but I recognize the ache, right? I don't know how that's true. We just know that it's true. It's something to do with innate, primal, intimacy and empathy for our fellow creatures on this earth. We know when we see someone is wounded, we go, oh, I know that. I know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. Or at least I can relate to that. And so I just always, you know, I just feel like I feel like my better nature comes out when I'm writing stories like that versus trying to be political or trying to write the next, you know, living in D.C., of course, you're doomed, because everything is so, all of the you know, playwriting there and theaters there is always political.
No.
And I feel like in some ways resisting that is maybe something that sets my work apart. Because people know you go to an Audrey Cephaly play, you're not gonna get politics. You're gonna get relationships.
Right.
So if that's what you're into, you know. So I think it's good, and I hate the word brand, but you know what I mean. Like, it's good that you have a recognizable voice and brand, so people are like, yes, I could probably pick that play out of a lineup.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I think voice is definitely the right word, because brand feels
voice, sure,
too,
yes.
You're transactional, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a better word.
I want to ask you, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you about the experience and opportunity that NNPN is specifically providing you in this moment. Like, do you feel this as a moment for this particular play, an opportunity, and the possibility that what it could lead to?
Oh, I mean, 100%. It's not like Alabaster hasn't been workshopped before. It has. And while this is not a workshop per se, certainly this time in the rehearsal room these past 3 days has shown me even more about my story and these characters, ways that I really need to kind of groom the script in preparation for launch, you know, things that are confusing to the actors that I really kind of need to clarify still. So just at a base level, anytime I can get in a room with professional actors and listen to them interpret my work, and a talented director like Jason Parrish, who, this is my first time working with him, love, adore, amazing. His instincts are crazy. Listening to him, you know, really exploit the material and also trip over it sometimes is so educational for mm-hmm. me. So that's gold. That's solid gold. And that's just at the default level. Mm-hmm. But I think the exposure, you know, of this character study, you know, a lot of times these understated plays, they don't always get all of the, you know, all of the, it, you know, all of the attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I've maintained for a long time that, well, I'm just going to go my own way with it. And eventually, you know, something will kind of open up for me. And I feel like it really has in the past couple of years. You know, I have three world premieres coming up this year. No writer gets that.
Mm-hmm.
So the exposure definitely here at NNPN, and these people that really, really believe in, you know, connecting with each other, these theaters that really believe in promoting new work, being in a showcase like this or a festival like this where the emphasis is on new work and boosting the signal, writers, we just don't get that. We may get a play lab or a workshop,
yeah.
But we don't often get, like, a chance at national exposure like this. And so the significance of it for me, I fully geek out about it. I'm not, I think it's incredible, and I'm honored to be here, and I feel privileged to be here.
Does it feel like pressure? Like, are you concerned about tomorrow, your showcase tomorrow?
I am not concerned, is maybe not the word, although I have had times when a reading was coming up where I was fully concerned because of one reason or another. But I think our actors are so on it, and Jason has found so much in the material, that if it goes anything remotely like how it went at the Florida Rep Workshop, you know, they're the submitting theater for mm-hmm. this, it's going to be great. The play is always sort of elicits a very vocal, lively response. And so I only have that to go on, you know, previous audiences. So I'm not concerned. I'm, of course, nervous.
Right.
But I always am, whether it's a workshop or a reading. I'm maybe not more nervous. I don't think the stakes are necessarily higher, but it feels like they are.
Yeah.
You know, it's a reading.
Right.
So it's easy to say, oh, but if we mess up, these are human beings. They want us yeah. to do well. It's not like there's a test or anything.
It's interesting because the worst case scenario is the same as the worst case scenario at any reading ever.
Yes.
But the best case scenario
yeah, yes.
is so much
yes.
bester than yes. any other opportunity, right?
Yes. And if the script has some critical flaw, well, there's nothing I can do about it now.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like I can be, you know, it's not like I can fast forward and go, oh, well, obviously I need to cut the second act in half. I mean, hopefully, you know, plays that are production ready and curated for this, they've already sort of been vetted for that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you have a script that's a mess, it doesn't really, it's, you know, ostensibly doesn't get to this level. So structurally, I hope it's all there. But there's probably not something that could potentially go wrong or off the rails that's going to change its chances one or two degrees in either direction. Either they like it or they don't.
But what's great is they're going to like it or not like it on its merits, not on, like,
how
you got some shitty lead central actor
yes,
or, like, the director just didn't understand the material, right? And that's why it failed. Like, it's getting the opportunity to be presented in its true colors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in front of such a large,
yeah,
you know, all these theaters is really unprecedented. This is really amazing for me.
Okay, so here's an excellent thing. When we recorded this conversation, Audrey's showcase reading of Alabaster hadn't happened yet, and there was all this uncertainty. Well, dear listeners, there was an unbelievable response to that reading, and as of the day I'm recording this, which is in early May, 10 theaters have signed up to do a rolling world premiere of Alabaster. 10 theaters! That's ridiculous! I mean that in a good way. And it's truly deserving. Alabaster is a hilarious and beautiful and brilliant play, and I couldn't be happier for Audrey. Moving on, next up is Lisa Langford. Lisa earned a BA from Harvard University. She studied acting at the Juilliard School and completed her theater training at the American Repertory Theater Institute for Advanced Theater Training at Harvard. After working with Dr. Maya Angelou to develop Dr. Angelou's line of social expressions titled Life Mosaics, she received her MFA in playwriting from Cleveland State University. Her play, The Art of Longing, was a finalist for the Leslie Scalapino Award for Innovative Women Performance Writers and a semifinalist for the O'Neill Conference. It was subsequently produced at Cleveland Public Theater. Lisa was also a finalist in the Playwrights Realm Scratchpad series and selected for the National New Play Network's Cross-Pollination Project. Her 10-minute play, The Bomb, about the Black Lives Matter movement, is published in the anthology Black Lives, Black Words. Here's my conversation with Lisa Langford, recorded in the giant lobby of Embassy Suites in Sacramento.
I'm based out of Cleveland, and I've lived there since 2002, but I'm born and raised in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, yeah.
And went to college in Boston. Then I...
Which school?
Harvard. And
I've heard of it.
Yeah. It's a small school.
Yeah.
Not too far from the Charles River. And then I moved to New York, then L.A., then Kansas City, then Cleveland.
Oh, you've been
so
all
that's
over.
My geographical...
Yeah, Boston's... I grew up in New Hampshire, and so Boston's my home city. And I lived there for a very long time, mm-hmm. too, because growing up in New Hampshire, you don't have a city, right? Like, Boston's all you got. So when I graduated from college, I was like... From undergrad, I was like, I got to move to Boston. And I just... So I spent, like, my 20s there, basically.
All the places I want to move now are far too expensive for me to live.
So. Yeah. I have a... I don't know. I just need to live in a city. Like, there's something about the city. Although, recently I've started to think about having animals. Like, I want to own... Like, I was watching Audrey's play today. I was like, I want a goat.
I want a goat. Oh, that was so cool. I loved that.
I want to have, like, 4 chickens, a goat, and a couple dogs, and maybe, like, a cow or a horse or something. And I'm like, can I have that and live in a city?
No.
At the same time? No. Yeah.
Like a tiny house or something.
Yeah.
The rest of the lot is animals and farms.
Yeah, that'd be, like, one weird... house in the neighborhood with these animals. Although I lived in Hollywood for my last year and a half in Los Angeles, and there was one house in the Hollywood. I mean, you've probably been there. It's like densely populated. It's house and apartment buildings just like on top of each other, and I was right in the middle of Hollywood. There was a house that had 20 chickens.
Oh my gosh.
Giant turtles. That you would walk by, like I would walk my dog and I would see like a turtle the size of this table roaming in the yard. And I'm like, what is that? And then they would have like 20 chickens and a couple roosters. And I was like, this is crazy.
A couple of years ago, they're like in someplace like outside of like between like Cleveland and Ashtabula.
Yeah.
There's a guy who had like exotic animals. And he shouldn't have. Because, like, you know, they're not made for the climate in the Midwest. So he had, like, you know, tigers and leopards and, like, just... And ostriches. And, like, they were just in a horrible state. And they may have mauled him to death. I don't remember the whole story, but but I remember
most,
it was, like, yeah.
That would be the most fascinating part of the story. You're like, whatever.
Don't have animals you shouldn't where you shouldn't.
Right. Yeah. I don't want... I love animals. I don't want any... that could maul me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I keep those where they're meant to be roaming.
Oh, God, I hope my cat's still alive. I think it is.
Speaking
of animals.
Your cat might maul you when you get home. Cats are tiny.
All her teeth have fallen out, so
okay.
She might gnaw me to death.
Yeah. That would be kind of cute. That's a cute way to go. So you grew up in Buffalo.
I grew up in Buffalo, New York.
Mm-hmm. And were you... Right, doing these podcasts, I've learned there are a couple different forms of people that become playwrights. There's The one, and so I'm wondering if you're one or the other, or if you're like a new third category. The one that was always writing from a young age, like in a journal and a poetry, and that evolved into dramatic writing, or acting as a young kid in theater, and then that became writing.
I'm the actor turned writer. Yeah. I like acting the most.
Yeah.
It's what I like to do. And I started writing to kind of like facilitate that because I got older.
Yeah.
I'm 52. Uh-huh. I'll be 53 in March. And like, I like sex and hope and laughter and love.
Yeah.
And when you see plays with, you know, like you see plays now and it's like, oh, that's the grandmother. She'll be dying by the end of the act.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And you're like, no, I want to have sex.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I started trying to write characters who were in my stage of life.
Yeah.
Because I see a lot of plays that are kind of like about the teen years.
Right.
And yes. Yeah. Those are super intense and they're, you know, you fall in love one day and you want to throw yourself off the building the next or whatever. But like, there's something that happens in the late 40s and 50s, particularly in women, but where you kind of have a second puberty because of the hormonal changes that are going on. And you're just as insane, probably, as a 16-year-old. And then when the peak of it passes, can I say words?
You can say whatever you want.
Okay, yeah. Like, you don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
There's a don't give a fuck gene. Like, remember when Al Gore and Tipper Gore got divorced and everybody was like, how? You kissed her so passionately.
Right. On Saturday Night Live.
Time,
right?
Yeah. That we all saw. And if you had acted like that before, we would have voted for you. But, like, and they got divorced. Like, divorce happens in the early 50s because women no longer have that nurturing gene and they just want to take care of themselves and hang out with themselves. So I like, I'm like, I want to get people of color, like, well, black people and old people. That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Well, you're not old.
Well, bless your heart. Thank
right?
you. I mean, closer to death than I ever.
If you're old, I'm 45. I just turned 45. Mm-hmm. So if you're old, that makes me, I have to rethink like the youth I pretend I have.
Well, I'm closer to death than I've ever been.
Right. Yeah. Aren't we every day?
Like in 30.
Such
in your
an 30s, existential thought, right?
Yeah. In your 30s, you're like, whatever.
Yeah.
And then your 50s, you're like, no, I'm going to die soon.
Yeah. I don't know if your relationship to your relationship to death changes as you get older, but I hope that mine does because I'm petrified of it, and I hope that I hope I have the luxury of aging first of but that when I do get older into my 60s, 70s, 80s, that I ease into a comfort, right? Mm-hmm. Because I don't have it right now. I'm angst ridden when it comes to thinking about death.
Yeah, like, I mean, tragic death, nobody wants that. Like, I don't want to be beheaded or sawed in half. the reason I was thinking about, like, John Gotti. Remember he chained the guy to the radiator and, like, sawed him in half?
Right.
It's just like, I don't want that to happen.
Right. You're worried about one of the least common ways to possibly die.
Right. But my dad, who's, like, a total dick, like, died peacefully in his sleep. You know, like, you asshole, you know, just.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of like
how I would like to go. Yeah.
That's the amazing way to go. And that feels like it's as uncommon as being sawed in half, right? Like, imagine the luxury of, why are we talking about this? Dying, but having everything in order and all of your goodbyes and everybody's comfortable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I would feel like that would feel like a great gift to give to people because the dying is harder on everybody else, right?
I kind of think that's what religion does.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you like, oh, you're not dying. You're going to a really happy place.
Yeah.
Or a really hot place.
Right.
You know, wherever you're going to go.
Yeah.
And I think like when you don't have that, it's kind of like, you could be scary, but, or it could just be like turning off the TV and all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Blank screen.
So. Do you fly a lot?
Not as much as I used to, and I'm not as at ease as I used to be.
Yeah, I feel like I'm confronting mortality every time I fly. I never thought about it when I was younger, but I just, you know, I flew from Chicago to Sacramento, and I was thinking about mortality again. The miracle of these giant heavy machines flying through the air, and how I can't wrap my head around the fact that there are thousands of these in the air at any given moment,
mm-hmm.
and they're not dropping. Like, I don't get it, and I kind of feel like it's going to happen.
Remember that lady, because I was thinking about this, remember that lady from last year that got sucked out of the plane?
Yes.
Okay, that was a thing.
Oh, yeah, I know. Thing,
you know.
I know.
How do you even?
Yeah. So what do you,
let me tell you the name of my play. And yeah, my name, too.
Yeah.
Oh, hi, I'm Lisa Langford. And my play that was here as part of the National...
New Play Network.
New Play Network Showcase of New Plays. It's actually NSPN, right? National
yeah.
Showcase.
But it's NNPN.
I know, but the hashtag we used was like NSPN.
2018.
Unless I'm using the wrong one. And
no, that's the
I'll
one, and I
out.
Couldn't figure out what
I don't
the
know what the acronym
meant.
Is. Yeah. Oh, but my play is Rostis and Hattie.
Yeah. Mm. And and Rostis and Hattie are
robots.
The two most fascinating characters I've seen dramatized in a really long time.
Well, thank you.
Can you describe who they are?
They are they're loosely based on this picture I saw on a blog somewhere. But like this part is true. In the 30s, the Westinghouse had an idea that they were going to create these androids that would like do our laundry and our cleaning and fight our wars and take care of our children so that we could have more leisure time, because that's what Americans
right.
need.
Yeah.
And then like the war effort came along and they abandoned the idea. But the picture I saw, the robot, and they were like, you know, not that sophisticated, but they were still robots, and they kind of looked human, had brown skin, kinky, like had a little afro, and like, you know, they looked black. And
yeah.
I was kind of, you know, fascinated by the idea of like, you're making this amazing futuristic thing. You're so forward thinking, but you've grounded it in this stereotype from the complicated past. Why? And then I was like, oh, and because I remember I saw it, and then I went out for a jog.
Yeah.
And I, like, this one scene came to me, and I'm like, I do not have time to write a play. And I just kept running, and the more I would run, the more I was like, okay, I probably have to start this when I got home. And so I did, yeah.
There's this amazing moment. You know, when you go see or read any play, there's, like, this beginning period where you're like settling in and you're wondering what the play is, right? What's this play about? And you know, some characters are entering and establishing who they are, and they're like, I found it to be this amazing moment when we learn about these two robots, and because then it's like, oh, that's what the play is about. Oh man, we're in for a ride. And What's amazing, the experience of your play, like, I found it to be amazing because I had that thought and had no, like, and then it goes somewhere else.
Totally.
It still stays in the, like, the reality that you created, but, like, it goes to another level entirely. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying anything because it's, like, wonderful spoilers that I don't want to spoil, because you will hopefully be getting a role of this.
Yeah, I hope a lot of people do this. But like, can I say that? Is that even a thing? I'm sorry I said that.
Yeah, say whatever you want.
But no, I know the theater that I'm kind of affiliated with, or they nominated the play.
Yeah.
If that's the process that I don't fully understand.
Yeah.
But it's Cleveland Public Theater, and Raymond Bobigan is the executive artistic director. And the spoiler is something that I was about to change, and he said, let me see it. And he was like, no, keep it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm really grateful for that. And they're going to do a production of it, I believe, in October of 2019. And so
that's rad. That's great. There's actually this, and I'm not sure if all of these conversations are being recorded when I'm having them, but I've been having so many conversations with playwrights and other people about moments in plays that go unexplained, or there isn't a logic that from our understanding, right? Mm-hmm. And there's sort of, like, in my experience, a camp of people that need that need a logic and need an explanation. Like, how did that happen?
Sometimes they're actors too, and yeah. that's annoying. Because I would get people that were like, I loved all the actors in my play. I loved the director.
Yeah.
But I would get people that were like trying to make sense of something, and I know for me as an actor, I'm just like, it is what it is. My job is to get it on stage and convince you that I believe it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that's all. Yeah. I mean,
and I suck at science
fiction.
That's
all I need.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, you kind of wrote a sneaky science fiction
But
play,
I'm like,
right?
How does this happen? I don't know. And that's what I liked about Alabaster.
Yeah.
If we can talk about where she
yes.
had that little section where...
By Audrey Cephaly.
Yes. Yeah. Where Alice talked to the goat.
Right.
And then they were kind of like, ask the author. And there's just, like, that was really cool to me.
Yeah,
that
the moment of metatheatricality. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Where she was able to, like, advance the plot without drawings, and I may totally steal it, without drawing anything out, just saying, like, you're going to find this cross. And then the cross comes back. And it was just like, oh, I like that.
I know.
That's really clever.
I know. I know. Yeah.
So, yeah, like, sometimes it's just like, if you were in this world, just be in this world as an actor. You don't need to... I think we do that a lot. I'm a guest artist at a School of the Arts,
uh-huh.
and it'll be over December 20th, thank God. I'm so horrible. I'm the worst teacher in the world. I should never be near kids. I'm just like, I hate you all. Why are you like this? I'm just... Yeah, I don't have that gene.
Yeah.
But... everybody wants to bring the role to them.
Yeah.
Instead of, like, the whole point of this is that it's play. Why would you want to play your everyday life?
Yeah.
No, like, let's go to the moon. Let's be circus clowns. Let's be cowboys, you know?
Yeah.
So when you get actors who want to totally ground everything in their own reality, it's kind of like, no, no.
Yeah,
let's
yeah. Just, yeah. Or not just that, but just be able to have, like, the rules spelled out really specifically, right?
And I don't know them, yes.
Yeah, but you just don't need them, I feel. Like, I feel like people who are yearning and calling for these things are just afraid, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they just, like, need to let it wash over them.
Yeah.
Just go for a ride. And, like, and that's exactly what this play is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a ride. You're taking us for a ride. I mean, it's a like... It's a dark and funny and scary.
A romp through
and
time
wonderful.
And race.
Yeah, there you go. You just wrote the marketing blurb for
thank you.
For Cleveland. So you simultaneously are, like, you're simultaneously an actor and a writer.
Yes.
Do you write consciously with your own performance in mind?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what's funny? There's usually a plus size 52-year-old black
yeah.
woman
yeah.
in all my plays. Because
yeah.
I'm like, yeah, if you want, I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I haven't.
Yeah. Do you need to get permission to audition for your own?
And I always wonder how people who write stuff for themselves, like, how to, you know, I'm trying to think who does that? Who does that where they're always in their stuff? There used to be someone who did that.
Well,
I mean,
Anna
like,
Deavere Smith. Well, she does, but she does
she's
like
a
solo.
She's a one-woman show,
yeah.
Yeah. So she, yeah. So she gets to do that. But I mean, like, if you just write...
Tracy Letts?
Does he write himself into his
I don't
stuff?
Know. But yeah. I mean, he's a playwright, actor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You are a unique... you are unique in that way.
So, yeah, I tried to, but so far nobody's let me do it yet. So.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you need to just flex a little, like, playwright muscle and say,
like,
this is my play.
Yeah.
I know the perfect,
I know
there's
the perfect
only one actor
this,
who
yeah.
could play this role.
So.
So you kind of imagined Hattie, you embodying Hattie
mm-hmm.
in this play?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Just
yeah.
from the start, yeah.
So did you have a relationship with Cleveland Public?
Yes. Well, I first met them as an actor.
Yeah.
They did, this was probably 10, maybe even 12 years ago, they did Adrienne Kennedy's Sleep Deprivation Chamber,
mm-hmm.
and I played the Adrienne Kennedy role. I don't
mm-hmm.
remember the name of it, but so I was worked as an actor there. And they had this program that was called Black Box that would just give you the chance, and I'd never written a play before. And I read... oh, my gosh, what's the name of it? Invisible Man.
Okay.
And I'd never read it before. I didn't read it until I was in my 40s. And I was like, somebody should make this into a play.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that he didn't want that. Right. That's, you know, like, that's why. And it was around the same time that Barack Obama was running.
Yeah.
And there were so many similarities that I like kind of did this weird mashup. And CBT was the place where I could, you know, for like $600, like that was our budget. And put on a show.
Yeah.
And that was like the very first piece I wrote. And then I think I did another one there. And then my first full-length play they produced, it was The Art of Longing.
That's great. So this is sort of a, I don't need to put words in your mouth, but is this a creative home for you?
It's like,
you
think? It's a kind of playwriting home. Definitely. And they're very encouraging. And Raymond, the executive artistic director, has very strong, very good ideas.
Yeah.
And he likes to let you know.
Yeah.
So that's really cool.
Yeah. And you're clearly wired to be able to handle these kind of things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I'm sure I, you know, go home and cry
for
15
right.
minutes and then I shake it off or whatever. But also they do the kind of work that if I want to say, you know, if I want to jump into a different century, they're not there saying our audience isn't ready for that. They're like, why just one century? You know, like
right.
they do progressive, imaginative, innovative work.
Yeah.
So,
and the audience is game for
it. Oh, my God. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The audience would be pissed if you didn't there, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you know that this play was being sent to NNPN for consideration?
I did, but you know what? I kind of did the thing where, like, you know it's happening, but you limit the amount of information you get. So I was like, just tell me what to do.
Yeah.
I'll do it. And then I want to go back into my life because I don't want to be like going, oh, I hope this happens. I hope that happens. Cause in a way, I kind of don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Do you know what this is? Did you know what it was, what NNPN Showcase was and the possibilities and all of that?
I did and I didn't.
Yeah.
Like, I vaguely knew, which is why I was like, yes. And then I was like, I don't want to know anymore because I didn't want to be like, oh, I hope this happens. And then it doesn't.
Yeah.
And I have a friend who's a playwright and he said, the best way to look at it is to say, I wrote a play and I got to go somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so I'm still kind of doing, I wrote a play and I got to go somewhere and meet some really cool people.
Yeah. So what is your, you know, I haven't talked to a lot of hyphenates like you, actor, playwright. Most of the people I talk to tend to be like, I'm a playwright and I write plays and I write it and I send it out and I hope the world responds and I write the next one and I send it out and hope the world responds. Do you have that part? Like, do you send your plays around or are you focused, you know, in Cleveland and like connecting with like Cleveland Public Theater, for example?
Like I said, I belong to a playwriting group.
Okay.
So they encourage us to like write.
Yeah.
You know, like and that's kind of fun to know, like, you know, oh, I gotta do something this year.
Yeah.
Otherwise you just like, you know, write for years and not have any focus.
Yeah.
I look online all the things that beginner emerging playwrights might do.
Yeah.
Like, was it Playwrights Helper?
Playwrights Helper,
and
Playwrights Center has a lot of stuff.
And there's a blog now, like in New York City Playwrights or something. There's a couple of blogs.
Yeah.
So anything I see, anytime someone's having a contest.
Yeah, so you're sending your things. Yeah. You're sending your things around.
Yeah, and I'm learning. Like, you know, there's always like, don't pay people to read your plays.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I made that mistake, and early on. And the feedback I got was so stupid. I like paid $20 to get that extra, you know, reader notes. And they were so dumb. I got so angry because they were about like the title and they were about the formatting and they were about the layout on the page. And I'm like, I wrote a play about something. Look, when are you going to talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't care about this. Aesthetic of my script, you know, I don't care about the title. Like, that's not the most important thing for me to talk about, is my title, you know.
No, but like, that's that thing Because I think there are people who probably read a ton of plays.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like the dedicated literary managers right. who are dramaturgs or something, who have a passion for it. I mean, like, you think about people who just read a ton of plays and they get jaded.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, another one of these stories. Oh, you didn't, you know, format it right. Oh, you know,
right.
They're not really into like, how can I bring this story to life? I think those yeah. people are few and far between.
Yeah, you know what? I think you're spot on there, because I was talking to a literary manager yesterday who was talking about the submissions that they get for like their festival, and every year there's sort of like a groundswell of plays on a certain theme.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. what they're finding is like, it's not that like they suck. Right, it's sort of like a bunch of them are really good,
mm-hmm.
but they're not going to choose multiple plays on the same exact mm-hmm. theme. So they're like, you know, we do think like this, the theme of like the Iraq War is crucial in this moment, and you know, mm-hmm. We want to pick one of these plays. There are 50 of them. We love 12 of them.
Mm-hmm.
We need to pick one of them, and I find that interesting. And they were just talking about how every year there's another. Like, it's different every year, but there's always, like, a bulk of plays that are... Like, I'm sure this year mm-hmm. there'll be 50 plays that are about robot servants traveling through time, right?
Oh, no!
I'm sure that's a common theme. But they can only pick one.
Wait, you know what? It might be a good HBO show like Westworld. Oh, wait, no!
Are there themes that you find yourself circling in your writing?
Yes. Lately it is... Do we have time?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Lately it's What is Blackness? Because I'm working on another play, and that's a riff that I came back to, and I was like, oh, I already did that. And I was like, yeah, but did you answer it? I was like, no, I didn't. Like, what does it mean to be black?
Yeah.
Yeah, and also... honoring the past, like having respect for everything that is part of our history as African Americans.
Yeah.
Like, those are just themes that are really, really important to me. And I hope when they stop being what I want to write about, like, I'm interested in finding out what the next thing is, because it seems to be aging. There's some stuff about being a woman.
Yeah.
A lot of times, too, though, if I'm in a show as an actress, it starts to influence me as a playwright. Just from Rosas and Hattie, I had done Top Girls right before I started it, and I wasn't ready to give up Marlene.
Yeah.
So she became a character in Rosas and Hattie.
Now I see that.
Yeah, because Marlene is like, why is she named Marlene? It's like, because she is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I guess the stupid negative way to call it would be stealing. But I love the honoring of our other plays. Like, mm-hmm. I call it honoring, because it's a sort of acknowledging these things. Rather than just saying, no, mine's just totally different, you're like, no, this is like, I'm honoring what, like, Carol mm-hmm. Churchill wrote,
mm-hmm.
and I'm taking it to...
Thanking her for the experience of playing Marlene and
I'm taking it to another place, right? Yeah, I really like that a lot. So you're able to write... while you're in, like, rehearsals and performance of another piece?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Oh, now I can't, now that I've thought of it. No, I'm just kidding. I hope so, because I'm about to start rehearsals after Christmas for Revolt. She said Revolt Again by Alice Birch.
Okay.
And then I'm getting ready for... who cares? King Lear.
Oh, yeah?
In April, I think, or May, maybe.
And what are you playing in Lear?
Reagan.
Nice.
Poking out Gloucester's eyes.
Right on.
Yeah.
So the reason I even ask about when you're working on another show that you're performing in and writing, I acted for a minute in my life, and for any new actor, the hardest thing in the world to do is remember your lines, is to memorize. And I just spent so much time, like, reading and reading and reading and reciting and reciting and reciting, just mm-hmm. getting it in so that I could learn how to then perform it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I can't fathom is also writing something else while I'm trying to take in another script.
But as a playwright, like, what I love, and I'll write some crazy stuff where, like, people are talking three different ways and they got to say all these words together. And I'm like, I don't care. I don't have to say it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, so I'm like, I don't have to remember this. Whereas, like, if I'm in a play, like, that's where I...
Yeah.
Like, start now.
It's really, yeah, I'm really fascinated by your ability to sort of compartmentalize in that way, you know?
Well, as I get older, we'll see. You know, I'll shoot you an email going like, no, I can't anymore. I thought I could, yeah. But I cannot.
After this conversation, I got stuck in my head, and now I can't do all these things.
Damn,
thanks
this
a lot, Brian.
Man.
Right. Yeah. You were an actor first, right? Mm-hmm. And you did you struggle to be seen as a playwright because you were known as an actor?
You know what? Because I'm not like in the heart of like New York or Chicago or LA. Mm-hmm. I think that places like Cleveland, where there is so much theater, there's more room to kind of say, oh, look at what I'm trying something new. I went to an audition, and I remember the artistic director saying, oh, I didn't know you could act. You know, I always thought of you as a playwright. And
wow.
It's just like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That means you have fully hyphenated, and either word could come first at that point.
Right? I hope, yeah, yeah.
What do you have anything at the moment that you are like specifically like hopeful for or yearning for as you leave Sacramento?
True love.
Yeah.
yeah. In addition to true love.
Yeah.
No, I would like to see a full production of my work in a couple other cities.
Yeah.
Because I want to see, like, you know, I'm posing a question. I'm talking about something that I think is important about, like, race relations.
Yeah.
And I think that good conversation can be sparked from my play. So I would love to see it done a couple places. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, like, what's that conversation going to be like in Cleveland? Mm. What would it be like in Boston? What would it be like in
Sacramento?
Phoenix,
yeah.
Sacramento,
yeah.
Yeah, around the country.
Or Alabama, you know, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Mm. I really want that for you. And I want that for this play.
Yeah.
I hope it happens.
Yeah, for all of us. Everybody here, I hope everybody here gets something.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. That's really the thing. Like, when you meet good people, it's hard to be, like, cynical and jaded. It's sort of like, they're good people. I want the goodness for me and for you. Like, mm-hmm. For all of us. Yeah.
Good things. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, we're going to stop now.
Okay.
Thank you for giving me some time.
No.
This was awesome.
Problem.
I wish we had like 3 more hours, though.
Aw. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And I'm going to listen, so.
Oh, good.
Anyway. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much to both Lisa Langford and Audrey Cephaly for spending time with me. I recommend you take the time to find their work on New Play Exchange or wherever else you can find it. If you are in any of the 10 cities where Audrey's play Alabaster will be playing next season, go see the play. You will love it, I guarantee it. The music at the beginning of this episode is from Dr. Turtle. The music you are hearing right now is from Jan Tyrion. The theme song for the subtext is from International Pen Pal. The subtext is produced and edited and hosted by me and presented by American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group. Thank you to everybody at American Theater Magazine, and thank you for listening all the way to the final seconds. The play that's filling me up this month is The Burdens by Matt Schatz. This play is running, or maybe it just closed, at City Theater in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is such a funny and brilliant play. It is told mostly from the perspective of a brother and sister who communicate mainly through text messaging. You wouldn't think a play that is mainly two characters texting would work, but it does. And it does brilliantly.